Dark Wings.
Dork Words.
The Game of Thrones podcast.
Season 2, Episode 2.
The Nightlands. Welcome back, everyone. I'm your host, Chuck Davis, and with me this week are...
Craig McCallie.
Mike Herger.
Phil Jonak.
Thanks, fellas. All right, we've just finished watching episode 2. And once again, Phil, as the unlearned member of our crew who has not read the books...
The illiterate member.
You didn't learn to read in the last week?
I was kind of working on it. I got through... a little children's book, but...
All right, so I'm putting you in the hot seat once again, and we want to get your virgin POV on what you just viewed, and then the rest of us will reflect upon it in the context of having read the books. So just give us your,
My standout moment, or my standout moments?
Sure, start with that.
Probably... the thing stood out most to me that I'm reflecting on is Stannis King is now I'm kind of getting with the Lord of Fire, you know. Not sure where that's going to go. You know, that so far everything's kind of been war with men, except for the dragons at the end of season one. You know, you see shit starting to ramp up there. But we got some supernatural power coming with the Lord of Fire here.
Do you believe that there's something supernatural about Melisandre besides her breasts?
Which those are, they're quite supernatural, I suppose.
They were firm.
They've made a point to kind of step into that, you know, this is greater than men. We're bringing a new god into the mix, but it seems like outside of the false gods and the whole kind of mimicky worship of the first episode this season, they wouldn't introduce us to that if there wasn't staying power on that front, I don't think. So.
What else?
We didn't see Bran this episode at all.
True.
Which is a little strange to me, I guess.
So you want a little more follow through on each of the major players. You want to touch base with them in each episode.
Mm-hmm.
Two other players didn't show up either. Who were they? Jamie/Rob.
Yeah.
And who was the other? Well, I guess Danny was almost completely ignored, except for the one thing. Anyway, go on.
I guess they gave us a splash, you know, first episode, kind of touch you up with everyone, and now they're pulling strings and pulling you off in a few different directions, you know.
Well, yeah, they just barely... We got a brief glimpse of Arya and Gendry and Yoren and the whole crew at the tail end of last episode, so we spent more time with them this week.
We did.
So, what do you make of that situation?
Well, I'm not sure if they're going to make it to the Night's Watch at this, this pace. That much I know. If I was the guy, I would definitely throw the bull helmet out at this point. That's an identifying point. And, you know, I might cut and run if I could.
He worked really hard on it. he's very proud of it.
What I wonder is how long does it take word to get back to King's Landing? How fast do ravens fly? How much time have they got here?
That's a very good question.
I think they only have 2 gold cloaks on horseback at this point because they were just like, oh, just go do it. Go handle it.
Yeah. You know. Go find out what's going on.
This is an easy quest.
But was it only the time frame is?
Or were there a couple other mounted men sort of on the periphery of your vision?
Were there?
I think it's just the two.
Just the two, okay.
I thought it was.
All right, so that was kind of a cool situation where Arya and Gendry bonded over there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it's all pretty book accurate for the most part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have some character building between the two there.
For sure. How about Tyrion and Cersei, the banter and interplay there.
The push and pull. She kind of got the upper hand this episode, how they worked it out, I think. She really left him stone cold, you know.
With the smackdown, like, you killed mom?
Yeah. I would think that they would have gotten over those issues by now in their adulthood.
But... that old guilt trip.
And no, you're right. That's one thing that stuck out for me is just Tyrion sort of being at a loss for words.
Yeah, I don't think we see that much. And there was a little emotion in his eyes, the quick blinking.
We touched on that last week when we said that Jaime got shut down by Rob and Cersei got shut down by Tyrion. And this week, Tyrion kind of got shut down by Cersei. Anytime any Lannister is silent, they're defeated.
And I'm sure it's the only one of the Lannisters that the crowd watching was kind of like, oh, you know, because we love Tyrion. We're made to love Tyrion.
Yep.
And I see that his mistress has now been exposed to the eunuch, which that all bets are off now. Everyone knows who's in King's Landing now.
Which, yep. That's kind of not really book accurate, is it? I mean, they're not up in the Hand's quarters.
It's somewhat.
Meeting up for drinks.
For tea.
Yeah, you mentioned last week there was like a whole secret passageway thing where he had to pull a bookshelf.
Varys was, yeah, complicit in the whole help me hide the fact that I have brought this whore to King's Landing. However,
against the king or against Tywin's wishes,
right?
Bad, you know, bad move in a way.
It seems a little casual the way that they're just letting Shay hang out in his quarters. But I think the whole thing of Tyrion coming home and finding her with Varys is a scene similar to one that we saw in the books, but it was at the, whatever, sort of the mansion,
the one house of the brothels or whatever.
Not the brothel. He had like an estate
outside of the red. For her.
Outside of the Red Keep.
Keep, yeah,
right.
Which is like the inner sanctum of
King's Landing.
Not just King's Landing, but the like the castle proper,
the regal part,
right? Okay, so what did you? What's your read on Varys as a character at this point, as a viewer?
It's slimier than Littlefinger, more or less. You know, I mean, kind of similar arcs, you know, of information gathering and using information, but.
But what do you think his motivation is?
That's a good question. I don't try to question a eunuch's motivation. Because it's not tits, I'll tell you that much. Although he was quite smitten with the gal, so.
Fish pie, they but, said.
Yeah, they really...
He doesn't like fish pie.
They really went with the pussy references there, to be blunt. It really did it.
True enough. What other major events happened this episode?
A lot.
Theon goes back to
Pike.
Yeah. Spurned.
Yeah.
The welcome he expected from, especially from his.
He doesn't even know sister. Who his sister is. Apparently,
he almost did.
Well, he knows her. He knows her better than he knew her before.
Yeah, that's probably true.
No high-fiving during recording. Yeah, what's your read on Yara and Balin Greyjoy?
There's quite a bit of loyalty there. Obviously, this is the first I've seen both characters, so...
That's a pretty interesting exchange that Balin and Theon have about the iron price and you know, who's... your brother and who are you loyal to and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and Pretty Boy Stark, you know, born into gold, more or less stolen from the war, I guess. You know, the Stark side of things.
The people on the Iron Islands remind me of Klingons. You know?
A little Next Generation flavor.
Yeah.
That's all about honor and glory.
The iron price, the blood price, the honor, all that junk that no one else in the episode or in the whole series believes in or considers.
TOS Klingons or TNG Klingons?
Whoever's honorable.
That's one of my favorite scenes from this episode, if not my favorite completely. Partially just for its capturing, you know, the source material, the tone of it perfectly, but also just an intriguing introduction to new characters. And I think they stepped up their game CGI wise or matte painting wise with the, we got a couple really nice views of Pike.
Yeah, they look great. It was really, really nice.
I don't think they still, I don't think they still do matte painting. That's pretty old.
They probably do a digital version of it.
Yeah. And we saw it for the intro in the first time, too.
We saw a new intro.
Yeah.
That's right. It made it to the title sequence, which is fun. We saw Dragonstone last week, and it was featured again, along with Pike this time. Very nice.
We got only a little taste of the Khaleesi this episode.
Just enough to Khaleesi.
No high fives.
No high fives.
Just enough to show they're still pretty much struggling where they're at, you know.
She got a little head this episode, and we could say that. But
what? Ooh. Oh, I see.
We're still talking about decapitation?
Yeah.
Ricaro's head. That was, I'm colorblind for one thing, but is it clear that blood was dripping out of the pouch when the horse pulled up?
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, oh, maybe one of the blood riders set back some water for the group.
It's either blood or fruit punch.
But, I mean, that wasn't...
Hawaiian punch.
That wasn't in the book, was it? It wasn't a... I don't remember.
Ricaro is still alive in the books, as far as I recall. Yeah. So I was disappointed that they did away with the only blood rider whose name I could remember. okay, so...
We've noticed that, just anecdotally, nudity is now so common and expected in the series that they don't even warn you at the beginning. It's like... Oh, there's some violence and language and adult content. But everyone knows everyone's getting naked, so we're not even going to tell anyone that.
Well, you were audibly disappointed when you didn't see nudity listed.
That's, you can't prove that. That's, don't listen to
it. It's before the recording.
We weren't rolling at that point.
I did almost go home.
So that was very surprising when we got to the whole fucking montage.
Which was quite a montage, you know, stitched together scenes.
With a whole lot of scenes that aren't in the books at all.
I'm disappointed. Okay, before we get into our book comparisons.
All right.
Just any parting thoughts or comments, like your initial impression of what was depicted in this episode and what's coming next?
And what's coming next? Are we still talking about sexual scenes?
Just let go.
No, it's a play on words.
Yes. use the sexual scenes montage as a metaphor for the greater story.
What's coming next? I still assume winter is coming. There was a reminder in the play-in, but not during the episode.
We got a brief glimpse. What about Craster's Keep?
Yeah, that's where I was going next was... Stuff's a little iffy there as far as what's happening with the, presumably the male children.
Well, one thing about TV shows like this, when you kick it off with the previously on Game of Thrones montage,
yeah,
you know that everything that they show from the previous episode is going to be germane to something that happens in this episode, right?
You got to train yourself to forget it so that you don't. So you're still surprised?
A little bit, yeah. But, you know, when they linger on Craster and it's like, don't touch my wives, and then they clip to John saying, well, what about the sons? What does he do with those? What do you think about that? What do you think happened there?
I think it's, well, if I had the Lord of the Rings guy's name memorized in my head, the guy who built an army... It looks like they're building an army of male Saruman. Craster children, pretty much.
The White Walkers are?
Somebody that looks bigger and larger than a normal man.
That's really all they gave. It was pretty shrouded.
It was pretty shrouded.
Perhaps a tree person, something like that, a troll. I could, you know, speculate.
A snark
for...
or a grumpkin, yes. Perhaps?
Which, that's mentioned many times in the book, but that's the first time we really...
Never fought either of those
choice
things.
Words in the
Dragon Warrior. I've never fought either of those beasts.
Are we talking about Final Fantasy?
kind of.
Okay.
No, that was a cool detail from the books that they included was the missive from Castle Black being sent to court, and Tyrion talking about the Night's Watch is requesting more men because they say that the dead have risen along with the cold.
Everyone's
winds.
Already walking away from it.
We kind of forgot about that TV wise from season one. You know, that was a long message coming.
Yeah, because you get that kind of in the first few episodes of the first season, I think, and then.
Well, there was
everyone just forgets about it, and it's like, ooh.
Well, there was the one actual encounter with a dead person.
In the first episode.
Being...
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you, when
he attacks
Lord Commander Mormont in his quarters, and Jon saved him.
And I take it that's the word coming down finally now about that.
Yeah, they're trying to convey that message to the kingdom, which is obviously wrapped up in let's cover our Lannister asses and... make sure that
they have no time for this make-believe pish-posh, you know, and metal slimes. Now I'm just Dragon Warrior again.
Hence the Snarks and Grumpkins reference.
And we see Sam smitten, obviously, in this episode.
He likes it when those girls walk away. But what disappointed me was that those girls were, like, completely covered in dark furs.
Yeah.
There was, like, no shapely form. whatsoever to drool over.
At that point in time, you would see a shapely form in your mind's eye, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, back in medieval times, I think imagination was power. So,
knowledge is power, power is power, imagination is power.
Gold is power.
Sam expressed his interest in delivering a child because he had read about it a bit.
He's a lot more confident now than he was in the first season. I mean, he's kind of rolling with his homies and not being all,
he's not as stuttery and pathetic as he's conveyed in the books.
He wasn't even in the first episode of the season, was he?
He was pretty involved in the visit to Craster's Keep conversation where they talk about the daughters and the wives and Craster and
he
all
had a
that.
Quick suggestive glance there, if I remember. A certain buck-tooth wife, perhaps.
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 Gilly. Did they name her Gilly?
Mm-hmm. I can't remember if that was referenced when she spoke in the first episode, but I think we got that this episode.
No, but she was featured. She was the one that Craster grabbed and said, "Read your line about how great I am." All right. anything else you want to reflect upon before we get into book stuff?
I'll just keep looking as we're rolling the episode in the background here.
Okay, well, speak up if see something that sparks a comment. What about you guys? Reflecting upon what we've read versus what we saw, what's different, what stuck out for you guys?
I mean, there's probably like 30% of the episode that was not in the books pretty much at all, I would think.
Yeah, there's some...
seemed like there's quite a bit.
Some important stuff, some banging.
Who we saw Theon banging the ship's captain's daughter.
That happened in the book.
That was pretty accurate.
You kind of get the things about the Salt Wives and a little bit of that point of view. I don't know if it's like super explained, but
I think maybe Theon ruminated on it more than he sort of spoke about it to her as he was banging her.
Yeah,
right.
It was just kind of explaining what a salt wife is very briefly.
Yeah. But that was pretty the way it was in the book.
I think that was the moment that it came up and she was conveyed as, "Oh, please take me as your salt wife." And he's like, maybe smile with your mouth closed.
And stay on the ship. God damn it.
That was very effectively conveyed, I think. And him disembarking on the shore.
And no one knows who he is. He's just like, "I'm the heir to the Iron Islands." And the guy's like,
who cares?
Yeah.
He got just such a chilly, when that's like it was in the book, such a chilly reception. He thought he was going to come back to great regency and homecoming. I think they even used that word, and everyone's just like, nah. You're mostly Stark anyway.
You smell like Stark.
Yeah.
Yeah, what about the whole riding on horseback with his sister and groping her?
He didn't get that far in the book. That was pretty
and, well, she
disturbing.
Was,
what
she
is that, second base?
I couldn't tell.
Is that third base?
I thought it was more tummy rubbing. It didn't look like he was really down
tummy
low.
Tummy sticks?
It depends. I'm not sure how tight her waistband was.
She probably had a chastity belt, I think. They
only
had
one way to find out. I ask around, I guess.
Your peers?
I feel like she was more... there was more witty interplay between them. First of all, she should be hotter than she is.
Yeah, she should have been.
I mean, she's got a good sort of demeanor for that character.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, the
her
way...
Her face is just not doing
her face is the face of a commander of men. Back then.
Back then.
Apparently.
Yeah.
According
to
Balin.
She was right on with the flirty, like, the way that... who was she in the book? Asha? Asha?
Asha and is now
she,
Yara.
Is now Yara.
She was much more deft at, like, sort of playfully flirting with him, but also sort of deflecting his advances.
Keeping him at it.
She didn't just let him grope her all the way back to Pike.
Right.
And then say, oh, surprise, I'm your sister. That's a weird... I mean, these are like important details that are being glossed over a little bit.
Yeah.
It sort of belittles her character a little bit, or makes her seem a little scummier and less shrewd.
She's pretty intelligent in the book, pretty wise, and she might still be.
She's like on her game. She's scheming and maneuvering, and she, you know, schemes circles around Theon.
Yeah,
who thinks that he's the
like
shit.
The shit. Yep.
Yeah,
that may be her kind of you know, how what's the dad's name? Baylor.
Balin.
Balin just let him have it. He gave him a lot of rapier kind of
really
dress
him down.
Really dress him down. They may have been her way of dressing Theon down for not being around, for being with the Starks, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it's clear that she was saving the surprise to kind of sting him.
And when she did the reveal, she very much gave him a kind of a fuck you, you know, smirk, I guess.
I imagine it's a lot more of a made-for-TV reveal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's, I guess, the visual, the visceral.
Visual or visceral, or both?
Visual.
You feel it in the gut.
Yeah.
It's where you feel it.
Is Pike like you imagined it? Are the Iron Islands like you saw it in the book?
I believe so. Yeah. I was very impressed with the way they gave a couple good lingering shots of the Pike from multiple angles. As described, I think they got Pike more right than any of the other major iconic castle locations that we've seen in this show.
The only thing that, like, they just showed it, we're kind of replaying the episode in the background, but it was kind of like sunny and like green. I didn't imagine it like that at all. I thought it was kind of more like rocky, and it's like really hard to get into from the
completely gray. And wasn't it rain? It was storms all the time. The storm gods, right?
No, storm gods is a Baratheon thing.
Oh, okay.
But it was
in the book.
I believe it was depicted as stormy and raining, and like when he was crossing the like rope bridges from one tower to the next.
Yeah, I did see a rope bridge,
big breakers against the rocks, and
it was
stuff like that.
They kind of highlighted how treacherous it was.
Yeah. And, I mean, it looked kind of treacherous, but it was so sunny out that you...
Right.
It looked so beautiful. And they rode the horse on the beach. And
But it was somewhat appropriate to Theon's anticipation of sort of a glorious homecoming. You know, before he got the smackdown from his old man, who basically said, "You're like no son of mine."
You're worse than my daughter.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I love that whole conversation represented so much about who the Greyjoys are and what Theon's relationship is to them, And, yeah, that parting shot of, you know, you don't stand a chance against the Lannisters by yourself. And he's like, who said anything about the Lannisters? So just a whole eye-opening, you know, the Greyjoys have their own designs agenda. And plans completely.
We lost Craig to nudity.
I'm right here.
Describe it. No. I can't see it. I'm facing the other direction.
That's all right. Someone ends up crying. Let's not talk
describe
about
Littlefinger's conniving.
Let's talk
interest.
About.
Let's talk about things that are new to everyone here. Apparently.
Okay, I'm really disappointed personally in Littlefinger being depicted as like a pimp, essentially.
You're kind of like a heartless pimp.
Maybe heartless pimp. Yeah. I mean, he's runs the, you know.
Well, he in the books, I always thought of him more as kind of like the chess playing man behind the man.
Right.
Like he funded and profited from the brothels, but he didn't make his home office within one particular brothel and also do all the pimping for the whores of that particular brothel. Well,
they definitely reminded us in this episode that he is he can be or is heartless. That he's the way that they did it, they wanted to make sure that you knew that he was completely ruthless and could be, you know, basically he said if you don't do it right, put on a happy face, I'm gonna turn you over to someone bad or worse or kill you or whatever. And you know, that is kind of a little bit of a departure from the books because he was always so cool.
Had, you know, distance from all the people he was manipulating. He was like untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
He was profiting from and playing everyone.
He just kind of pulls the strings and then gets out of the way and nothing really comes back to him. And here it seems like he's really, you know, active in that and is kind of really involved.
Yeah, this is pretty direct involvement here.
I'm still confused about the whole, you know, all the screen time that they've dedicated to this prostitute from the north who ventured south and entered into Littlefinger's brothel. And, you know, why, you know, especially since they sort of depicted her as like the super shrewd whore of the north who had the smarts to follow the money to King's Landing. Get the gig in the super high-paying brothel, which apparently, according to the disgruntled customer we saw tonight, you know, the clientele pay twice as much for what they get in this particular location because of, you know, the heightened level of service or whatever. So, you know, why, first of all, she would be like the shrewdest whore of them all, but the most torn up over the baby killing. I understand sort of the momentum of that whole narrative of, oh yeah, remember that baby got killed in the brothel and decent people are upset about it. Littlefinger clearly isn't one of those decent people. And then that fed into the next scene where Tyrion does the dressing down of Janos Slynt and sends him packing for the Night's Watch. And that follows into his confrontation with Cersei, where he accuses her of issuing the order to have the baby killed. And that plays into the whole, you know, the people, we have like a morale or like an image problem. And
we need some PR people to take care of this for us.
That was a pretty broad simplification of the dynamic that was happening in the books. But I mean, I can appreciate how it serves the purpose of driving the narrative that Cersei's out of touch and doesn't give a shit about the people, and the people are suffering and angry and not happy with the Lannisters, and that Janos Slynt is kind of douchey. Well, he's, you know,
he's a pure, just a muscly yes man.
I think that scene was like very accurate to the book, where it's kind of like Tyrion kind of gets him drunk and gets him going, and then
plies him with the Cornish wine,
kind of, you know, like springs all this stuff on him. It's like, oh well, if you're gonna go to the Night's Watch here,
I don't trust you because asshole. You are, you know, for sale to the highest bidder.
Right.
Sends him packing and then realizes that Braun, who he has replaced him with, is just as pliable.
Yep.
That was a very effective scene. It's interesting. This is a case where they're eliminating a lot of tertiary characters. Tyrion did send Janos Slynt packing to the wall in the books, but he never put Bronn in that position to replace him. Bronn never led the Gold Cloaks.
I don't think that's till... He doesn't even really do that till the third book, right?
No, Bronn never does lead the Gold Cloaks, but he's always like... He's clearly Tyrion's like right-hand man, or at least his muscle.
Well, he's a City Watch leader now, not the Gold Cloaks.
No, the Gold Cloaks is the City Watch.
Oh, no fighting.
Fight.
No, I mean, he asked Bronn to sort of... Well, I shouldn't say this. No, I think Tyrion finds like someone else, like a knight, who would have been a candidate for leading the Night's Watch, but was too sort of noble. I think his thing was he was missing a hand or something. He was the guy who he replaced Janos Slynt with. But Bronn was only the captain of his personal guard, who he also asked to hire like other sellswords into his service.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way I remember it. So yeah, no, Bronn, even though Bronn aspired to advance his career in any way possible, you know, for the most part he was doing that in Tyrion's service, but he never had like an official position.
Comes later to something else, so we won't talk about that. But
I guess that's like a TV sweep of characters. I mean, we can't introduce a shitload of people at this point.
No, I mean, that's...
Well, we're assigning roles here. You get this.
You have to consolidate and sort of make composite characters. Another case where they've done that clearly is with Stannis and the whole faction that he leads at Dragonstone.
With Davos's son, apparently?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They have raised the profile of Davos' son. I don't believe they named him, but you thought it was Devon?
Maybe, yeah.
I think that's accurate.
Devon was meant to be Stannis's, what do you call it? Not steward, but squire?
Jester.
Not jester, but thank you for saying
religious,
jester.
Religious jester.
Because the character of, what's his name, Patchface?
Yeah.
And Shireen, Stannis' daughter, have been written out of the story, right. Clearly.
Apparently, yeah.
They imply that Stannis' wife is sickly and a pain in the ass.
Locked up in the...
Being a pain in the ass is true to the story.
Yeah.
But he has a daughter. He doesn't have any sons, but he has a daughter who is sickly. And a wife who is like fervent
religious zealotry, yeah.
And a motley jester
who
Patchface
drowned and then was brought back to life and has been insane ever since.
Yeah,
we missed a guy named Patchface.
No, he wasn't in the. He wasn't around.
It's kind of like Leatherface. This
Patchface
is how I
imagined
not, it.
I don't think we're ever going to see Patchface.
Right.
That's disappointing to me.
It's like Patch Adams, I think. Except better.
Stannis didn't do his resolute character any favors in this episode. He just seems flighty and easily swayed and cowed. And
it only took about 5 seconds to seduce him.
The flesh is weak, and like we were saying last week in the book, he's much more firm. He's a rock. He's very, very unshakable, I guess, and. So far in these two episodes, he's just been like,
"I'll do whatever you want, lady."
Flighty and like easy to sway.
Just take off your clothes in front of me, and I'll.
Well, I mean, she drank some poison. What are you gonna do? You can't say no.
And I think there was a where Melisandre talks to Davos' son. Apparently, there's kind of like a foreshadowing deal where she talks into his ear and talks about
fire.
Burning fires, like the way to go or whatever, basically. Which, that's... further down the line was this, for things.
Is that foreshadowing for him?
I think so, because on the Bywater Bay,
well,
can we, or the deal, the battle of,
we won't talk about that.
The Blackwater, is that?
Yeah. Blackwater, Bywater.
Breakwater, Blackwater.
We'll get to that. I believe it's episode 8.
Okay.
Oh.
The Battle of the Blackwater.
But I think that's, like, just for people who know, I think it's kind of like a, oh, I kind of get that, like, if this is, you know, Davos's son, because, you know, this happens to him later on or whatever.
It was a weird little moment. It was kind of, it just sort of shows the way that Melisandre sort of interacts with people. It sort of explains a little bit about
Rhaelar. They still haven't said her name.
They haven't said her
name. I don't think, have they?
I don't think so.
So maybe we should quit saying it.
And they haven't said Davos' son's name, but they did say Salador San's name.
Yeah.
Right.
And Davos Seaworth for the first time.
Yeah, I think they just said maybe Davos in the first episode, if at all.
They established that Davos was a former smuggler.
And they finally mentioned the cutting off of the fingers.
Indeed. Yep.
And you
could you tell which hand it was?
I couldn't. I don't remember from just sitting here, but you could kind of see like a glove or with like some flat.
Well, it looked to me. Fingers. I was thinking about like the way his
sword, I think it was his right hand because he kind of had that on his sword.
But yeah, maybe it must have been because his sword was hung on his right hip.
Yeah.
So implying that he would draw with his left hand.
Yeah.
So. You wouldn't draw a sword with the hand that had the fingers cut off.
So he's missing some fingers?
He's intended to be missing fingers.
They only mention it really briefly for a second.
I didn't know if it was just a, like, this is what happens when people pirate or steal gold, you know, your fingers get chopped off. I didn't know there was actual tie-in.
What happened, yeah.
Now, Salador says to him, he chops your fingers off and you fall in love with him.
Yeah.
But they didn't, it's a weird thing to say, they didn't explain the fact that it was Stannis' way of punishing him for being a smuggler.
Yeah, now that Phil said that, I guess thinking back, if you hadn't read the books, it could be just rhetoric. Like, he's just being kind of anecdotal
cheeky.
About it. Cheeky, yeah. But
could have been a metaphor. Yeah. He literally cut off his fingers.
You did kind of get, like, I mean, that whole conversation with his son where they're walking, like, after they talk. It's like son's trying to get him to convert to the Lord of Light and all this stuff. And he's like, you know, I just serve Stannis and that's, you know, all I care about. It's not, he doesn't serve
atheists.
He'll believe whatever, maybe God you want, but that's not who he really serves. He's really just doing, you know, whatever Stannis wants him to do.
They did a good job of establishing his loyalty to Stannis. His belief in the justice of supporting the one true king, the one true, you know, person who should succeed Robert Baratheon, but also his ability to influence people and his kinship and friendship with Salador San. They did a lot to establish who Davos is. Pretty effectively, I think, in this episode. So, Mike, you were reflecting on the scenes. Instead, like last week, we saw episode one of season two. And instead of like next week on Game of Thrones, it was like this season on Game of Thrones.
So we
saw scenes from multiple episodes, and you were expecting to see.
I was expecting to see a little of the Catelyn and Renly interaction this episode, but it seems like that's probably, you know, coming maybe next week. At this point,
possibly, very likely next week. We saw, well, as Craig noted earlier, Rob and Catelyn and Jaime were all missing from this episode.
Which, I mean, Rob's kind of missing for the whole second book, really. I mean, since he's not really a chapter type guy,
but as we talked about
and, you know, people speak about him, but
that's right. I mean, in the books, we only see Rob through Catelyn's eyes. I call her Catelyn. You can call her Catelyn. They call her Cat.
At least Littlefinger does.
You're probably right. Catelyn makes more sense. All right. I'll adjust. Yeah. We did see the bit about Melisandre promising Stannis a son. And I, for those of us who have read the books, we can infer maybe what that means.
We won't ruin it for you, as Craig would say.
Ruin.
Well, I think a son might be happening, it looked like. Conception.
And they really didn't care back then, did they? Just...
Well, there wasn't much foreplay.
I think it took a whole, like, 5 seconds. I think. He undid his breeches pretty quick.
Who has time in the movie world?
Yeah, you know, I'm not happy with the casting with Davos or Stannis. I think it might have been more appropriate even if they just swapped those two actors. You know, it's like Davos is always portrayed as looking like a commoner whenever he encounters these other sort of lords and people that he interacts with, because he's risen to this position in Stannis' service that is so lofty. He's always out of place when he's interacting with the Highborn. And, the actor's bearing of Davos is far more noble and confident than the way that the guy who portrays Stannis is behaving.
And just like physical appearance, I always imagined Davos is kind of like a thinner, kind of even more weakly guy who's, you know, I mean, is a smuggler. He's just kind of like sneaking stuff in. He's not really fighting people. And then, you know, Stannis is kind of like the bigger physical, you know, type guy, which, I mean, Davos in the series is kind of a lot bigger.
Yeah, so, Stannis seems short and...
Yeah, short and kind of...
Pliable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it
were we to be casting directors, perhaps?
If only we could go back and...
This again comes back to your willing of the show, I think.
This is not the way I willed it.
And I mean, did they have any input from, the author on it, or is it...
Absolutely, but I think he's just excited that his show's on TV and that there's a crew of smart, earnest fans, you know, producing and...
He's probably very complimented. In a way. He seems humble.
I don't think he's one to... Well, it's interesting, George R.R. Martin in the 80s spent some time in Hollywood as a writer for television, and he would write treatments and episodes for things like the new Twilight Zone and or the Outer Limits, I'm not sure which, maybe both. And he was a writer for the Beauty and the Beast TV show from the 80s. Linda Hamilton, exactly. So he knows the compromises involved in sort of writing for television.
And writing a book.
They did get a pretty good Kraken over the hearth there. I'm just looking at the episode.
Kraken.
That's a good...
It's good Kraken.
Good Kraken for sure.
Contextual. Sea-driven.
You finally get their sigil.
Yeah, I'm thoroughly pleased with the whole... Greyjoy aspect of this episode, and I'm pretty pleased with the whole Arya Gendry Night's Watch thing. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention: in the book, I believe it was Lannister men at arms or a patrol of Lannister soldiers instead of the gold cloaks that tracked them down, and I believe also. They didn't come right out and say that we're looking for Gendry.
No, I mean, it was like Arya and Gendry are kind of hiding behind like a hut or something.
It was an encounter that happened at a tavern, and they both were hiding, and they're both like, oh, they're looking for me. No, they're looking for me. And then afterwards, they're like, well, why do you think they're looking for you? Well, why do you think they're looking for you? But they, I mean, still the exchange and the, you know, moving the plot forward stuff that happens.
So what do you think about all the new Arya plotline kind of characters? Maybe they don't really get introduced, but I mean, if you've read the books, you kind of, I mean, you get like hot pie and
Lami and hot
Lami
pie.
Green hands. And
they did a good job of introducing us to those two characters and kind of how dopey they are. And also Jake and Hagar and Biter and Rorge in the cage.
Yeah.
Jake and Hagar's name, he introduced himself, but Biter and Rorge did not.
Right.
I was only disappointed by the fact that Rorge had a fully formed nose.
Yeah, I was thinking of, like, you know, more like Skeletor nose, like totally kind of gone.
Probably hard to cast someone that looks that way.
Can't live with an open wound like that.
Yeah.
But they effectively sort of removed Lord Voldemort's nose for the Harry Potter movies.
That's kind of what I imagined that, yeah, to kind of look like.
They could have done something. But, I mean, they definitely captured the crudity of Rorge and the bestiality of Biter and sort of the odd, off-putting charm of Jake and Hagar in that scene.
Agreed.
So that was good stuff. I don't know. What do you guys think? Anything we didn't touch upon that was noteworthy this week?
Probably.
Well, I mean, we kind of touched on the whole Jon Snow where he like follows Crast around to the woods. I mean, that's
happened in the book.
Yeah.
The whole thing where he catches a glimpse of an actual White Walker probably taking Craster's baby away. And the whole thing.
And that's not even in the second book. It's
Craster
in, like, the
knocking
third book.
Him out.
Yeah.
I almost think they're going to like accelerate the whole.
That whole
series
plot
of
line.
Events at Craster's Keep in a different way than they played out
because
in the books.
Isn't in the books they go there like on the way there and then they kind of stop on the way back and that's kind of where they find out the secret of Craster's Keep or whatnot.
Let's not ruin it for Phil.
We won't.
Or our other
the secret of Craster's Keep.
Listens. The secret of Craster's Keep.
Well, I think he already spoiled it because you mentioned the.
Did I? Saying the thing about White Walkers?
Yeah.
Well, but that's all. Implied in the books.
Yeah,
it's actually not spelled out. I feel like they played their hand more boldly in this episode than Martin did in the books.
There's been talks of armies too, you know, I mean, and they can only reference where these young boys are going. How many times, you know, you're thinking, well, they either take them out back and shoot them or
make a sacrifice to them to someone or something. Or just trade them for protection,
yeah,
or something along those lines. So no, I mean it's not explicit that it is a White Walker. I mean in the books, I want to say even in the pilot episode of the show, where we do get like a good firm glance of a White Walker attack. Don't they depict the whole thing about how the White Walkers bring like this like. Debilitating cold with them. They like emanate the cold. Did they do that on the show or am I just remembering it from the book?
I don't think they
did. I don't remember.
The cold brings the walkers, but the walkers bring the cold is kind of one of the things. But if so, I mean, if John were literally within such a close distance to an actual White Walker, they ought to have done the thing where like everything seems to be freezing around him and stuff like that. They depicted that somewhat in a season one episode, didn't they?
Couldn't remember if it was just creepily snowy and blowing cold or windy or if it escalated when the White Walker was alluded to.
I mean, the only time you see the White Walker first season is the first episode.
Right.
Well, like we said, too, the elemental... like Melisandre was supposed to emanate heat all the time and there were a lot of things in the book where she was... You know, people could feel it, not just see it.
She's pretty and charismatic. And she's growing on me, the casting decision of Melisandre. But you're right, she doesn't have a supernatural air about her.
Right.
Although, I mean, Phil picked up on that, where she appeared to have an innate power, which maybe you read from the whole I drank the poison and didn't die kind of a thing.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
They did do a thing this episode with her where it seemed like there was a point in time where she said something and someone could have defied her or gone with her, and then they just showed a long shot of her eyes, like giving them the old wily eyes, and then
Well, I don't think it was long enough.
The whole Stannis command thing, you know, I mean, she just turned a guy, a king, apparently, like this, trying to snap into the mic.
Well, it's, I mean, it's accurate that Melisandre seems to have Stannis, you know, under her thumb. But at the same time, she believes in Stannis for her, because of her visions, you know.
Right.
She's not necessarily as, I don't know. Like
she's
her,
kind of a...
Her motivations...
She follows whatever she sees in her visions, basically.
Yeah, it seems more of a command and utilitarian, or using Stannis kind of deal for me.
But he's like a messiah. I mean, from what she relates anyway, that it's...
That's the way she tried to introduce him as, like, that yeah. Legends say that the hero that will save us wields this flaming sword or whatever, which he briefly touches, and then he's like, puts it out real quick, and then Excalibur. Storms off.
Well, it's kind of hot. It's kind of warm.
And they didn't mention Azor Ahai.
Right. Did they
the
last
prince
episode?
That was promised? No.
They didn't?
She just said, legends speak of a hero that will come. So they're glossing over some of those sort of legendary details.
Hmm. Okay. I must have imagined it.
Well,
is there anything else? What else is there?
I think we pretty well rehashed this episode.
It seems like a setup episode,
yeah.
More I mean, so than an in-your-face episode.
We kind of got some more, I mean, there was no Jaime, there was no Catelyn, there was no Sansa.
No Joffrey. No Hound.
Yep. So I think we kind of got the characters that we didn't get a lot of last week.
We got the Greyjoys well established. We got Stannis and Melisandre and Davos better established. Move the plot forward on Arya and Gendry and the Night's Watch folks. Move the plot forward on Sam and Jon and the Night's Watch at Craster's Keep.
Little entanglement with... Varys and Tyrion.
Right.
First real non-subtle entanglement, maybe.
Yeah, we kind of didn't talk about that, where they kind of have their wordy exchange of kind of gets a little heated.
Yeah, they're trying to talk in quiet voices, but I'm pretty sure the whore can hear them. I mean, she's right there, so.
True. That's true. Yeah, I mean, the whole depiction of Shay and her circumstance is poorly handled, in my opinion. But they did do a good job of showing, like, Tyrion's first power play as the, stand-in hand for his father, where he dispatches Janna Slynt to the wall.
Right.
That was pretty cool. And did a good job of kind of showing
the relationship with Cersei, like, kind of,
yeah,
she really, I mean, how much she resents that he's the hand of the king right now, and pretty much, you know, kind of has
all always
the say, basically
always resented him for, she's always blamed him for her mother's death.
Yeah,
not just hand of the king, resents him because he's alive.
Exactly.
Which, yeah, I think in the book you really get a good sense of that, like, I remember that whole exchange. It was pretty heated discussion, I think.
Too true. All right, well, I think things are progressing nicely here in season 2. Any parting thoughts, anyone? Craig?
We have to go watch this Melisandre love scene real quick, but...
no, pretty covered. Exactly what they said.
All right, then. We'll wrap things up this week, and we'll see you guys next week for episode 3. Anybody know what it's called?
We can only
episode 3.
All right. See you next time.